Lent, these 40 days leading to Easter, is a time to remember how God wishes us to live and to contrast that with how we're actually living. It's a time to turn from distractions, take on disciplines, and inch towards greater spiritual health and wholeness. The biblical text we've been given to start this Lenten journey is the story of Noah and the Ark. This is perhaps the Bible's most iconic story. It's especially popular with the Sunday preschool set, but its reach also goes well beyond the church. I mean, what's not to love about riding in a floating zoo, where purring lions lie down with innocent lambs and no one gets eaten? This is the good ship, peaceable kingdom, a place of safety for good girls and boys, protected from life's chaos and sailing toward the land of rainbows. No wonder there are literally thousands of children's books that utilize the Noah's Ark motif. Frances Landy, in her scholarly review of children's literature, notes that Noah's Ark is such a pervasive cultural object that it has become largely detached from its biblical moorings. It has entered a different canon, alongside the good news of Winnie the Pooh, Peter Rabbit, and Curious George. But I know what you're thinking. I heard your critique last fall of the book of Joshua. So I know a good 80% of you are silently mumbling, "This ain't no children's story." In fact, it's an awful tale of horrific violence with a seascape of bloated corpses. And who's responsible for this genocide? Genesis 6:7 tells us, "The Lord said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I have created, people together with animals, for I am sorry I have made them." This may be the most sobering sentence in the Bible. And it's also the proverbial smoking gun where God admits that this mass drowning was his doing. Peaceable kingdom, my eye. Of course, if that's what most of you are thinking, there's at least another 10% of you who are saying to yourself, "Wait a minute, we're having Carl preaching an Old Testament text again? Have we learned nothing from the past?" And then there's the 10% of you who are thinking about lunch. Tofu or lentils. Please let nothing I say distract you from that. But to the rest, I want to suggest this morning that our story is actually not so much about the flood or even the ark. It's about something much more redemptive than that. The flood story in Genesis is, in some respects, not all that original. Many ancient civilizations, especially those heralding from Mesopotamia or what is today Iraq, had mythic flood stories. Up until the early 20th century, large areas of that region were frequently devastated by flood. When torrential rain combined with snow melt, the Tigris and Euphrates would burst their banks and leave the country submerged under hundreds of miles of lake. In ancient times, this phenomenon gave rise to a powerful tradition of believing that there had once been a flood so overwhelming that nothing was ever the same again. In fact, in the ancient list of Sumerian kings, they are divided into two categories: antediluvial or pre-flood kings and post-diluvial kings. So the Sumerians had a flood story. The Babylonians had a flood story. The Akkadians had a flood story. It seems every ancient storytelling civilization had some tale about water's destructive power to wipe out towns, civilizations, and entire peoples. Some of the stories included building boats to survive the floods, or even sending out doves from their boats. These stories often interpreted the flood as divine judgment for all the ways people had made a mess of things. When the gods got angry, it was believed, A devastating flood was their way of clearing the deck and starting over. So it's not that surprising that later the Israelites also told a flood story, and that it shows up in the book of Genesis. However, Israel adapts the story to express a very different perspective about their God. They significantly alter an old tale to tell a new story. And to catch this new perspective, you have to read it the right way. If you read it as a historical account, as a story about a specific flood with a specific ark that actually carried pairs of every creature known to humankind, you'll get hopelessly distracted. Now, I know every illustrated children's Bible always shows two cute giraffes with their heads poking through the ark's roof, but don't entertain that image too long. Yet if you do, you'll have plenty of company. Jews and Christians throughout the centuries have invested huge amounts of time and effort to explore the supposed historical gaps. People have been searching for physical remnants of Noah's flood. They've studied geological flood records to discern when this actually happened. They've theorized about how Noah dealt with the challenges of carrying carnivores as well as insects, speculated about the food source to contain the cargo. Lots of dried figs is a leading theory. And of course, many have debated how they dealt with the daily deluge of dung. One earnest believer even ran the numbers and calculated it to be about 12 tons a day. If this is where your mind goes with the story, then book yourself a visit to the Ark Encounter in Kentucky, where for a mere $50, you can tour a 7-story, 500-foot-long reproduction, complete with explanation about where Noah kept the dinosaurs. But don't invite me, because I don't read this story as historical narrative. In fact, I don't think the flood is all that germane to the story. Rather, this is primarily a story about God. And its purpose is to ship us off to a new understanding of God's relationship with the world. To highlight this, I'll briefly review the story by dividing it theatrically into 5 acts. Act 1. In the opening scene, God comes to the conclusion that creation has gone off the deep end. Only a few generations ago, God had made the world, made humans in God's image, and placed them in paradise. Adam and Eve walked with God, which is to say they were connected with what is holy. And it was all good, very good. But before long, Adam hides from God, Cain murders his brother, and a spiral of violence swirls and swirls out of control. Revenge, murder, and rape become endemic among humankind. With the freedom God gave them, people had walked away from God's dream and instead preyed on the weak and grabbed what they could. What's a God to do? Act 2 is the courtroom scene. Here, the sentence for such a rebellious, sinful creation is announced. I have determined to make an end of all flesh, says God. I will bring a flood to destroy. This is an appropriate sentence for mortals who have disregarded and defied their Maker. And as we know from other flood stories, it is consistent with the prerogatives of the gods. Make the gods angry, and there will be hell to pay. But then comes Act 3. The one that goes off the script. Walter Brueggemann writes, with amazing boldness, the narrative invites the listening community to penetrate into the heart of God. And what we find there is not an angry tyrant, but a troubled parent who grieves over the alienation of her creation. The world, having rejected what God willed, does not make God furious, but deeply grieved. She is not enraged, but heartbroken. God has come undone. This then raises the central question of the story, the one Israel is grappling with. When humankind has gone astray, abandoned God, and chosen destruction, when the indictment against humanity is clear and the appropriate sentence rendered, can God change God's mind? Can God rescue that which God has abandoned? This is the crisis. It's not the flood. It's the heart of God. It's a conflict between God's judgment and God's pathos. In Act 4, we are introduced to Noah. Noah is odd. He does not fit into what we've been told about humanity. We are told that he walks with God, and we are told that he found favor in God's sight. Noah, it turns out, is a new idea. He embodies a way of living that so far has not appeared in the Bible. Noah is an alternative possibility, one who does not try to be God, but follows the way of God. And his appearance announces that faithfulness is possible even in this messed up, violent world. The narrator of this drama wants the listening community to turn toward Noah, to consider that in this troubled exchange between creator and creation, there is the prospect of a fresh alternative, that something new can spring forth from walking with God. In the climactic fifth act, we get the answer to the story's question. We see that the grief of God and the emergence of new humanity overrides God's judgment. The flood ends, and life begins again. The issue presented at the beginning of humankind's disobedience is resolved, not by God's indulgence of his anger, nor is it resolved by creation overcoming its way of violence. Rather, the resolution comes by the resolve of God's heart to fashion a new relationship. Argentinian theologian José Miguel Bonino writes, "God will be forever not the God of death, which so many then and now worship and obey, but the merciful God of life. This new alliance has no preconditions." God's way of relating is not dependent on the fidelity of a new humanity, which is a good thing, because it's clear soon after the flood that humankind is still hopeless. The tears of the waters have not changed that. In no time at all, Jacob will be stealing Esau's birthright, Aaron will be dancing around a golden calf, and David will be figuring out how to get Bathsheba's husband out of town. So the story of the flood is not a story about a change in humankind. It is a story about a change in God, who swears off retribution as a way of dealing with creation and chooses relationship instead. From now on, God will not let God's sorrow lead him to kill. God will bind God's self to creation in peace, promising himself to it, although he knows it will wound him. So God will be wounded. So be it. With this first remarkable covenant, God chooses to ally himself with his cantankerous creation, whatever the cost. If there is to be pain in the world, God will share it. Never will she protect herself from it by killing off those who have caused it. This week, 17 children in Florida were shot and killed in school. They are the latest gun violence victims in a country whose homicide rate is 49 times higher than comparable countries. Perhaps unsurprisingly, but still jarring, a recent study in the journal Health Affairs designated the U.S. as the most dangerous of wealthy nations for a child to be born into. And this bloodshed will continue until the day our devotion to children is stronger than our devotion to weaponry. Yet despite mass shooting after mass shooting, the day of championing life over weaponry has not come. Tell me, what is the appropriate judgment for such a wicked people? Seemingly, life on this terrible, beautiful planet can still be described by those pre-flood words in Genesis which announce, "The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence." And like the flood story, we are still given two contrasting images of God to choose from. The God who commands sacred violence to stop the flood of human violence, and the God who promises never to attack violence by inflicting more violence. And we have made our choice by worshiping here the God who, with love and a broken heart, embraces us and embraces life. We give praise to the God who has permanently set aside his weapon, placing the sign of the undrawn bow in the sky. That tells us something important about the nature of God and how God will not respond to violence in our world. But is God then simply resigned to evil or simply tolerant of human sin? Is there really little that our God can do to effectuate justice and peace in this life? Well, I think the good news is that God is not helpless. But God did need to find a new way of dealing with the problem of sin and evil. And that new way is pointed to in the Noah story. First, God chooses to be in covenant with us. And even though God's covenant with us is unconditional, we can choose to also bind ourselves to God. Covenant is the biblical word for the strange and strong relationship that God seeks. And while covenant may sound like a weak response to the urgency of violence, in it lies our hope. Paul Neusterlein, a Lutheran pastor and prominent Girardian, says, "Covenant is an ongoing relationship for the sake of getting to know who God truly is. It's a means of being brought to God. Living in covenant changes us and the world, perhaps at the speed of evolution. But don't think this change hasn't been happening in us and in the world. A different sermon could explore the many ways in which we are actually much more peaceful and accepting than our ancestors. Covenant is how we slowly but ultimately turn from the false god of retribution to the God of life. So the means of our salvation is a covenant extended over time and space, an ongoing, perhaps anguishing and confounding, but ever nurturing relationship with God whom we accept in baptism. Secondly, while announcing this covenant, God continued to entrust humankind with the mission of expanding, enriching, and protecting life. We, made in the image of our Creator, are partners in God's plan. We, too, are allies of creation. We, too, are lovers of life, which means we, too, are wounded and grieve the brokenness we see around us, the brokenness in which we ourselves participate. We are both breakers and healers, set into relationship with a God whose covenant calls us to shift the balance from death to life whenever and wherever we can. Finally, God's covenant with Noah and all creation declared that the new way of dealing with evil is not through violence, but through the way of suffering and death. In the New Testament, this is called the way of the cross. It is also called suffering love, nonviolence, and reconciliation. In fact, we can think of this way of suffering love as God's post-diluvial way of being powerful in the world. It is a way especially marked during Lent, and particularly when we get close to Good Friday. And today we recognize that this way of suffering love did not start with Jesus. It started with God's covenant after the flood. Lent, these 40 days leading to Easter, is a time to remember how God wishes us to live and to contrast that with how we're actually living. In a world steeped in violence, are we on a path that enables what is corrupt and violent, or resists it? God has a sign to remind God of God's commitment. And we have one, too, to help us remember. It is here, before us, in the bread and the cup. Do this and remember. Amen.